Here is a strange text upon which to preach. Jesus tells a story about how one of the employees goes to the boss, snitches on a fellow employee. He tells the boss that one of the managers has been embezzling from the boss. The boss calls in the dishonest manager and tells him to clean out his desk that very day. He also tells him he wants a complete accounting. Show me the books, he tells this crooked manager. Rather quickly, the manager begins to realize that he's in deep, deep water. He says to himself, I'm too old to start over. I've grown accustomed to my comfortable lifestyle. I can't make it on unemployment. I've got to do something. So this dishonest manager gets together with some of his boss's clients, and the swindle begins. Over a 3-martini lunch at an expensive restaurant, he meets with these clients for one last fling on his expense account. During that final lunch, he says, now tell me what you owe the company. Each of the clients reports what they owe. These are large accounts. They owe him vast sums. And then that little scoundrel says, look, you're great guys. Why don't you just write off what you owe us and we'll forget about it. We'll call it even. Now make no mistake about it. He's not doing the debtors a favor. He's writing off the debts at his boss's expense. It's a strange story. Why would Jesus commend this sort of behavior? Maybe you're saying to yourself, perhaps this manager was the victim of some sort of office politics. Maybe his coworkers had it in for him. Maybe they set up things against him, framed him to the boss. These things happen in corporate America. Or maybe you're saying to yourself, this guy really is a crook. He has spent his time not only swindling his boss out of his money, but there's no stopping him even after he's been caught. He thinks about nothing but himself. He's got no ethics, no morals, no standards of decency. What are we to make of this strange parable? Well, for one thing, we might agree that Jesus has one incredible sense of humor. I can imagine the crowds that day holding their sides and rolling in the aisles. They used to make movies about this sort of thing. Remember that old movie, The Sting? Remember how great it was when Paul Newman and Robert Redford outwitted the mob and swindled them out of their money? If a little guy is able to put this over on his rich boss, why should we care? It's funny. It's funny to hear Jesus delight in the little guy who swindles the big guy. After all, the big guy is a flush fat cat. He's got his. There's more where that came from. Did you ever see that old movie, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels? One crook tries to outwit another crook, and in the process, they both get outwitted by a savvy woman. It's comical. It's comical to see the little guy put one over on the big guy. It can be great fun to put aside our moral judgment, to lay down our ethical standards, our scrupulous reservations, and to sit back and enjoy the little guy putting one over on the man. And so it's amusing to watch this manager, who's in a desperate situation. He takes matters in hand, and by a dash of hook and a deal of crook, puts it over on the boss. But of course, it's not very moral. But then we get to the end of the parable, and it's lost its sense of humor. Jesus commends the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. Are there any principles here for Christian businessmen? The story is realistic and quite entertaining. But what do we do with Jesus' approval? How does this parable square with the Christian ethics? How does Jesus celebrate an embezzler? This may be one of the toughest parables Jesus ever told. There's some indication that Luke himself had trouble with this story because it appears that Luke adds a few clarifying verses at the end of the story, which have the effect of obscuring rather than clarifying things. Luke tells us that Jesus says we cannot love God and money, which is undoubtedly true, but what does it have to do with this parable? Luke also warns us to be careful of the one who is not faithful in small things, for that person will not be faithful in big things. That also is true, But is that at the heart of the scandal of the parable? When you think about it, Luke's explanation doesn't really fit the parable. What the manager did was clearly dishonest, and what Jesus did was to clearly praise him for his dishonesty. There's no way that Luke or you and I can weasel out of that. And along comes the learned scholars and the preachers. Through many contortions, they attempt to make this parable make sense in the usual way that parables make sense. They explain to us that perhaps the parable got jumbled over the years. They say that maybe the parable is hyperbole, some sort of strange overstatement that Jesus uses to get our attention. They wonder if the manager included the interest owed to the boss, and all he did was cut down the interest to the legal limit so that what he did was ultimately not so wrong. Perhaps the unscrupulous manager only cut down his own commission so that what he did wasn't dishonest at all. And on and on and on they go. But maybe the story's simpler than that. Jesus tells a story about a manager, albeit a dishonest manager, who, when faced with terrible catastrophe, recognizes the catastrophe and immediately moves to do something about it. It sounds simple, but look at us in similar circumstances. When adversity comes our way, we tend to freeze up or pull the covers up over our head or not get out of bed that day. We can become overwhelmed. We reassure ourselves with the great law of thermodynamics. If something can go wrong, it probably will. We decide that our number is up, that the gods have decreed that it's our turn to suffer when the roulette wheel of bad luck turns our way, and we give up. We do this not only in our personal lives, but also in our social lives. We look at what's wrong in the country, and we say to ourselves, I'm just one person, what can I do about it? You are told by your doctor that you have cancer, and you conclude there's nothing to live for. Your boss comes in and tells you that you're the latest victim of downsizing, and you decide your productive professional life is over. We circle the wagons. We move into a defensive posture. We hunker down, disinclined to fight a hopeless cause. I wonder if this parable tells us that this is not the way to live our lives. If even dishonest, unscrupulous business people know how to move from the defensive to the offensive so quickly, how much more should we be astute, be smart, be proactive? There's a story of a great rabbi who, when told by some of his students that one of his friends was arrested for burglary, the rabbi said, "My friend is a very great teacher." "How can that be?" asks his students. "Look at my friend the burglar," says the rabbi. "Every day he manages to teach me something, even in this. When we are resting and sleeping, he's busy working. When others go about chattering aimlessly, he is quiet and adept. When others are busy locking doors, he skillfully knows how to open them. My friend is an artist and a teacher." The story of the rabbi and the parable of the dishonest manager are analogous. It's outrageous, but even in its outrage, it can instruct. The gospel proclaims that there is a future, and that that future is God's. And so we must constantly be on tiptoes, alive to God's coming among us, ever watchful, alerted, ready to move. We are not to be anxious about our lives, to worry about the future gets us nowhere. Instead, we can recognize, we can trust that the future is God's. We're always getting confused into thinking that God's future will be just like our future. The future is always in our hands. Therefore, when the boss calls us in and tells us that the game is up, we hang our head and we go quietly to collect unemployment. We sigh, we resign ourselves to our fact, and wonder what anybody can do. But the good news of the gospel is that God is leading us to an unexpected future. An unexpected future because it's not one of our own making. It's of God's making. We are told an outrageous story of a man who makes some outrageous moves because he seems to be convinced that the future is amazingly open and surprisingly not fixed. I once knew a businessman who caught the wind of a rumor of a Fortune 50 company going to build a huge new plant on the outskirts of a little town. Knowing that, he immediately went out, borrowed money, and began wheeling and dealing, buying up properties, starting new developments, all in anticipation of a new financial chapter in the town's history. Other people in the town thought he was nuts. Of course, they didn't know what the future held, so he seemed foolish and reckless. Later, when the announcement was made and the factory was on the drawing boards, the wisdom and prudence of what he'd done became apparent. He knew something about the future, something that gave him confidence in that future. The unscrupulous manager took what he'd been dealt, rather precarious and bleak future, and he wheeled and dealed, worked with it with a faith that even this could lead to some good, and he received a promising future. By God's grace, so do we. We come up to the altar with empty hands. There, we receive just a bit of blessed bread, just a taste of blessed wine, not much to build a future on. But in the outrageous graciousness of God, those bits of ordinary daily life become transformed into miraculous, sacramental, God-fused future. And we go forth, eyes open, with fresh possibilities before us, a future not of our own devising, but a future of a gracious God. Today's parable is outrageously wonderful. We see in this parable some good advice for the future, but it's not the sort of advice that you'd get from seeing a counselor. People going through distress and turmoil in their lives are encouraged to dig down, to reach in, to draw on their natural resources. In today's parable, something completely different is going on. In today's parable, we are shown how to stride into the future, confident not in ourselves, not in our own abilities, but rather confident in the power and grace of God. And the one who told this story is Jesus himself, who not only told good stories, but also boldly moved to seize the future for the good. Even when he moved towards the cross, he did not do so as one resigned to his own bleak fate, but as one who confidently obeys the will of God, confident that the future belongs to God. Frequently, Christians have been accused of promoting pie in the sky by and by because we believe that God is in charge of the future. In reality, it's just the opposite. Because we know that the future is in God's hands, because we are confident that God is working to reconcile himself, to reconcile the world to himself, we are filled with boldness. We can move into the future with wonderful confidence and assurance, because we don't need to worry how it's going to end. Amen.